Thank you. Can you all hear me? That good?
All right. I have something I need to do first. Is there anybody who doesn't want to be on Facebook? Avert your eyes. No, not you. Okay, I won't aim at you then. All right. There you go. Thank you. I appreciate your indulgence. So thank you for the introduction. I had just such a nice time here. It's a real kind of whirlwind trip for me, but gosh, I mean, what a great town, what a great university. This has just been a wonderful trip for me. So thank you so much for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. This is a talk I actually haven't given before, so we may be in for some adventure here. We'll see how I pull this off. We will learn together. So I am Brian Fees, and I wrote the book She Said I Wrote. Mom's Cancer was started life as a web comic and became a book published by Abrams in New York. My second book was called Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow, and it's an entirely different kind of book. It's not a memoir. It's a kind of a history of the space age, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. My cartooning career began, well, I've been a cartoonist my whole life. You ask any cartoonist, and they'll all tell you they've been a cartoonist their whole life. But my semi-career began when my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer that metastasized to her brain at the age of 63. And these are photographs of me, my sister Brenda, who's called Nurse Sis in Mom's Cancer, my mom, and my sister Elizabeth, who's much younger and is called Kid Sis in Mom's Cancer. And I resolved to tell my family's story somehow. It was important to me to tell my family's story because even though we have a nurse in the family, my sister sitting next to me there, we kept getting surprised by things that happened to us. We didn't always understand what was happening to us. We kept getting hit by the head by 2x4s that blindsided us. And so I wanted to tell our family story somehow. And I have experience. I'd worked it as a newspaper reporter, and I'd done some writing, and I thought, well, I could write about it. I thought maybe I could even write a book about it, even though I didn't know how one went about doing such things. And instead, and I'll talk about why I made the decision, I made a comic about it. And I'll talk about why a comic in a little bit. But I made a comic strip about us. And I didn't know what to do with it. I wanted to get the story out somehow, and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know anybody in publishing. So I put it online. I put it online anonymously. And I serialized it. I started putting chunks of the story online a few pages at a time. And I didn't promote it. I didn't. It wasn't through any fancy sites. It was just a domain name I bought for $12. And I told a couple friends, "Go look at this thing and tell me what you think of it." And they went and looked at it, and they told me what they thought of it. And they told their friends about it, and they told their friends about it. And the thing went viral. It just caught on, caught fire, and without pretty much any effort on my part, I had thousands and thousands of readers pretty quickly, which was a strange and frightening thing, and a frightening and wonderful thing. So from that, a lot of good things happened for me. Mom's Cancer won the first Eisner Award, which is kind of like the Oscars of comics. It was the first digital comic. They didn't know what to call them then. They didn't know what to call them web comics or digital comics. And at the time, nobody was even sure if things that were online counted as comics if they weren't printed on paper. But then in 2005, they decided, yeah, those are comics. So they gave me a nice trophy for that. And as a result of that and some other things, it got published by Abrams as an honest-to-God book on paper. And that book went on to win another comics award called the Harvey Award. That says 2000 Harvey Award, 2007 Harvey Award, Best New Talent. I have an obligatory joke I have to make whenever I show this slide, and that is that when I told my wife I'd won the Best New Talent Award, she looked me up and down and said, "Looks like the same old talent to me." So my wife doesn't let me get away with anything. Mom's Cancer was published in three different languages, Italian, French, and German, and the German edition went on to win the 2007 German Youth Literature Prize, the Deutsche Jugendliteratur Prize, which I appreciated because that's not a comic book award. That's an award given to all books of all types in Germany. And that meant a lot to me. I was unaware until I won this award that I'd written a book for youth. I did not know I'd written a children's book, but apparently I did, and I was very, very happy to have done so. My next book after that was called Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow, and this is kind of the book I would have written if I hadn't written Mom's Cancer. It's a book about being a space-age kid and wondering what happened to that, how did that old-style optimistic utopianism we used to have turn into a pessimistic dystopianism? How do we go from Flash Gordon to Blade Runner? You know, how did our future go from bright and rosy and scientists are the good guys to dark and depressed and we're all doomed and scientists are the bad guys? What happened to that? And so it's a book that kind of examines that by looking at different eras throughout the space age. And it went on to win the American Astronautical Society's Emmy Award for Young Adult Literature. And again, I had no idea I'd written a children's book. It didn't even occur to me. But again, I was very happy to get the plaque. And then after that, I followed that up with a webcomic I just finished up called, that's the paperback, The Last Mechanical Monster. And I was talking to some people before I started. Last Mechanical Monster is just stupid fun. It's just a stupid fun comic I did and put online for free as an experiment just to see, just to do a story about an old man and his giant robot. And that was actually very, very therapeutic and relaxing for me. So why a comic? Why Mom's Cancer is a comic? That's the people really want, or you know, one of the first people have. And the first thing is comics are a medium, not a genre. Comics are a medium like film, like stage plays, like radio plays. It's a medium. It's a way to tell a story. It's not. They don't all belong on the same bookshelf necessarily, although that's where the bookstores put them. Comics is just another way of telling a story. And if you can think of it like that, well, comics can be funny, but they can also be serious or sad or adult or juvenile. And so, you know, that was my approach to comics. My decision to tell Mom's story as a comic actually happened one day when I went with chemo to her. And I apologize to anybody who was heard my earlier talk today, because it's the same story. Some of this is repetitive, but we'll get to the new stuff later. I took my mom to chemo one day, and I don't know if you've had chemo or know someone who's had chemo, but it's a boring process. You sit in a chair, and they put the IV in, and they pump you for 2 or 3 hours, and they give you sedatives, so often the patient naps. So Mom is in the chair, passed out, and I'd taken some homework to do because I had nothing better to do for 2 or 3 hours. And while she was sitting there, I turned a piece of paper over, and I drew that. And that's what she looked like sitting in the chair. She's in this big kind of Barca lounger easy chair, and she's got a little handheld electronic game in her lap, and she's got a strawberry milkshake, and there's just a random syringe sitting on the side table, and a blanket over her lap. And a box of Kleenex and a water bottle and a Walkman. And I realized that in that drawing, in that one drawing with the, 18 or so captions around it, that I'd captured more about what that day, what that experience was like than I could have done in 3,000 or 4,000 words of prose in an essay or 10,000 words in a book. That drawing was that day. That was that experience. And I decided then that this is how I'm going to tell my mom's story. And that became a page in the book. This is that page in the book about halfway through or a third of the way through the book. So I went home and I started drawing. I started drawing and writing. And I'll talk a little bit about the process of how I drew and wrote it. But I want to try something first. And I very rarely do this. I want to give a reading. And I'm very reluctant to give a reading of graphic novel text because you're all reading faster than I can talk. And so I don't know how reading comics works, how giving a reading of comics works. I'm going to try it. I'm going to ask you to restrain yourself from bolting ahead of me. But I'm going to try to do some readings from Mom's Cancer, and I'll do a reading later on from What Happened in the World Tomorrow. We'll see if this works. This is my experiment. So this is the very start of Mom's Cancer. And it starts with step one, how to diagnose cancer. Step one, rent a bad movie. And they were watching The Time Machine, not the good version from the 50s, but the bad version from 2002. And Mom's leg begins to tremble. She says, "My leg, I've never felt like this before." Kid says, "What's wrong?" And Mom says, "It's like I'm cut in half. My whole right side is gone." She lost all feeling in half her body. It was just absent. "Mom, you're scaring me. What do you think I'm doing to me? Call your sister." Kid sis calls nurse sis. Nurse sis calls me. "I don't want you to worry, but Mom had a small seizure tonight." And I'm on the other end of the phone. "Oh, okay." She's all right now. I think it's a transient ischemic attack, like a mini stroke. I've seen them before. I'll stay with her tonight, nurse says. And I say, okay. And I don't know if I was literally watching the Powerpuff Girls, but it was something not a good use of my time, I guarantee you. Nurse Sis and I talk about whether Mom should go to the emergency room. Nurse Sis has worked in a lot of ERs, seen a lot of folks stroke out. Mom recovered in seconds and wants to sleep at home in her own bed. I hang up. There's little more to do. She'll see a doctor in the morning. Everything's under control, I think. I don't lose any sleep. So I carry on, hoping life will be as normal as it could be. How to diagnose cancer. Step 2, see your osteopath. You can either stop smoking now or have a real stroke and spend the next 20 years half paralyzed in a wheelchair. Mom says, I'll quit. You had your last cigarette on the way in here. Mom says, okay, fine, great. And let's get a scan of your brain to be safe. And we get the first sign that there's something really bad going on in the brain. There's a side note. When I first started Mom's Cancer, and I did it online, my first thought was that it would be very allegorical, kind of Alice in Wonderland-y. And my thought was that, this is a total aside, so stick with me for a second, that my family and I would be humans, but everybody else in the story would be some kind of character or abstraction representing what they were. And so in the very first version of Mom's Cancer, the doctor here, the osteopath, was a giant duck because she's a quack, because she was a terrible, terrible doctor who almost killed my mother later on in the story. So she's a giant duck, and she's a giant duck for the next couple pages. The story continues. I draw more pages. The next time a new character comes along, well, they're kind of a random character in the book. They don't really represent anything, so I draw them as a human. And then a couple more pages, another character comes along, and I can't really think of anything good to represent them, so they're a human. And after about 30 pages, people are saying, you know, it's a good story, but what's with the giant duck? And so there was actually developed this big raging argument online about whether or not I should keep the duck, whether the duck made any sense at all. And when it went to print, this is the version from the print version, I turned her into a human being. But if you see on her lapel, she's got a little tiny duck pin. So she's still a quack. She's still, you know, that's her pedigree. She started out as a giant duck. So anyway, that's a little behind the scenes. Continuing the story. Start here. Osteopath tells Mom to find neurosurgeon in the yellow pages. Nurse Sis says, I'm trying to find a physician to see my mother. And Nurse Sis works the phone and works the contacts and works all her friends. Through dumb luck, she stumbles onto Dad's former secretary, now working for a neurologist, who tells her to send over the MRI. Through the kindness of strangers, totally random, there's nothing we can do locally. Meanwhile, kid Sis commiserates with an old friend whose mother has brain cancer. Another random chance. Let me email my mom's doc. And the doctor says, I can see your friend's mother on Thursday, which is how Mom got a date with the chief of neurosurgery at Impressive University Hospital, Stanford. Congratulations. We live in the San Francisco Bay Area, so she got excellent treatment at Stanford University. Somebody was asking me earlier today about the symbolism of the die and the pawn there, which is also the end papers of the book. And it's random chance, and the fact that we're all pawns, and as Mongo says in Blazing Saddles, all pawns in the game of life. Whether you live or die can hinge on having the right person come along at the right time, and that's sad and tragic and weird and shouldn't be like that, but sometimes it is. Mom waits for a phone call that isn't coming. It's no coincidence I happen to stop by. And Mom asks, do you think it's safe for me to exercise? And I say, I don't see how it could hurt. Mom doesn't know that Nurse Sis already got the call she's anticipating. Then she called me. My job is to stall. So I'm there just to keep things calm until Nurse Sis shows up with the information. But what if I speed up my blood flow and it moves brain tumor cells to some other part of my body? I say, I don't think it works like that. Nurse Sis runs more than her fair share of medical interference. I'm happy to let her. But what if, you should probably ask your doctor. Today's call is from Impressive Hospital to report new scan results. Mom's cancer may have ended up in her head, but it didn't start there. Nurse Sis, hey. Well, what are you doing here? Do you think it's safe for me to exercise? Some news you deliver in person. Amid the flood of phone calls and appointments, Mom calls a family meeting. It was time to discuss some things. The neurologist consulted with the pulmonary oncologist. They say it's a lung cancer that spread to your brain. The nurse says, we have an appointment at an impressive hospital on Thursday. When they'll take it out. Mom just had this undying optimistic streak that just drove us crazy. Kid says, they don't even know what it is yet. It's a brain tumor. I say, but the real problem is lung cancer. Jeez. At least it's a stage 4, says Mom. You knew stage 4 is bad, right? Why isn't Mom getting any of this? I'll have something to say about my attitude on the next page. She's weak, confused. I thought there were 10 stages. Mom, there's only 4. Shuffling, listless, dazed. She's aged 10 years in a week. So stage 4 means they found cancer in 4 places? No, Mom. We explained all this before. Why is she being so stupid? Is it the tumor, shock, an act? Because if this is some act, some sympathy ploy, some plea for guilt and pity, it's not very funny. Not funny at all. I take some crap for this among readers who ask, why were you so mean to your mom? And the first thing I point out is I wrote the book, and the reason you think I'm mean to my mom is because I wanted you to think I'm being mean to my mom. But that's kind of a meta lesson a lot of people don't get. But I resolved when I started telling this that I was going to be honest about it. And this occasionally brought out the best in us, but not always. And honesty was, the honest part was we did get frustrated with her. And she did strike us sometimes as being stupid. And she wasn't being stupid at all. She's a very smart woman, totally overwhelmed. She's drowning in this information that's coming at her, as a friend said, like trying to drink water of a fire hose. And she's just drowning in this stuff. She can't take it in fast enough. The three of us aren't being a ton of help. And this is a piece where kind of storytelling-wise, I'm trying to play what's really happening against the image you're seeing. I'm correctly drawing her as overwhelmed by this information. I'm coming off like a big jerk because I don't seem to realize that. I did realize it. I drew it. I wrote it. But at the time, that was an honest reaction. She was very, very frustrating because she just wasn't getting it. So, you know, that was part of the honesty, and I think part of what people respond to is we weren't always nice people, and it wasn't always pretty. So the process for writing Mom's Cancer, and I want to talk about this because I'm going to contrast it with the process for other works I've done, is gathering, editing, and shaping. I as things happen in our lives, I'd write them down. I'd write them down. I'd go home, and I'd write them down, and I'd do a little scribble, and I'd do a little thumbnail drawing in the margin, and then I would set it aside. And it would sit there for 4 or 6 or 8 weeks while I collected information. And then I started shaping it because I didn't want it to just be a diary comic of this happened to us and that happened and that happened and that happened. I wanted to tell a story. And I wanted to have character arcs. And I wanted the story to build and climax. Even though I didn't know what the ending of the story was going to be, because I was doing it roughly real time, I wanted it to be a story, not just a diary, a dry recitation of events as they occurred. That was important to me, and I think that's another thing that people kind of respond to is the characters do change, the characters do have arcs, action rises and falls, and it has all those things that fiction stories are supposed to have. Giving it a couple months to sit, let me have some perspective on it, and let me kind of shape the story that way. So, just from a storytelling point of view, that was important. Why comics? I inserted this 10 minutes before y'all got here, so I'm interested to see what it says too. Comics are a form of visual storytelling, and comics are a different type of literacy. These days, graphic novels are very big, and people talk about are comics pre-literate? Are they post-literate? Are they illiterate? Are comics just literature of illiterate people, of illiterate people? I don't think so. I think it's a different sort of literacy that demands the reader draw upon resources most readers aren't used to drawing upon. You have to be able to put words and pictures together, sometimes when the words and pictures aren't even doing the same thing. Comics excel at the use of symbolism and metaphor. For example, this, the picture of Mom drowning in information. I don't have to tell you she's drowning information because I can draw it. I can draw it, and you get that. You get that she's drowning in this information of medical words. I don't even have to say a thing. I can just show the water rising above her ears, and then she's gone in it. There's another page from later in the book where I draw my mom as the Operation Board Game character. And this does a lot of things from a storytelling perspective. That delivers a lot of exposition, a lot of background and facts. It tells you exactly what's wrong with her and what we're going to do about it, right? On two pages of the book, a lot of information is delivered, but it also captures kind of the absurdity of the situation, because there was a lot that was just absurd about this situation. Like, this just shouldn't be happening to us. This is wrong. This is silly. This is stupid. And so it's not making fun of her. It's not making fun of cancer. It's making fun of the situation, the absurdity, the kind of the dark, bleak, existential absurdity of life and death. It often boils down to, you know, kind of a big cosmic joke. At least it seems when you're in the middle of it. At one point, my mom literally said, as when we walked into Stanford, she walked into the clinic and said she felt like she was walking into Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory. And Stanford Hospital looks nothing like Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory. It's white and sterile and clean, and everything's all, you know, stainless steel. It looks like the inside of an Apple store. But to her, it was Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory. And some of this is factually correct. There is a mesh mask pinning you to a table, and you are strapped down so you can't move, because when they're doing the radiation, you can't move. They want to hit the exact spot. And this is what it felt like to her. So when she told me she felt like going to the hospital was like walking into Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory, I can draw that. I don't have to say it. I can draw it. And again, you instantly get that if you're taking the information in visually. There's another part where I was writing, and I told you I had to take these little notes, and I wrote a little note that said, balancing mom's medications is like walking a tightrope. And I immediately realized that's a horrible cliche. That's bad writing. It's very bad writing to say it's like walking a tightrope. That's idiotic. So I didn't want to say it, but I could draw it, you know. So I could draw her walking this tightrope while I'm describing what's happening to her physically. I don't have to talk about a tightrope. I can talk about the medication she's taking and the drive to the hospital and the crisis she goes through while she's walking this tightrope and a buzzard lands on the end of her pole and she's walking across a crocodile-filled pool and an elephant gets on the other pole and it just gets harder and harder and harder and then the rope catches on fire. I don't have to talk about any of that. I can show it. And then the very last panel concludes with mom asking, why is my vision blurry? And an off-panel voice says, take your pick. And that's literally something a physician said to her. She called the doctor's office one day and said, my vision is blurry. What's the problem? And they said, well, you're on 57 medications and you have a brain tumor. Take your pick. Which was the most callous, you know, kind of heartless, blunt thing anybody could have said. So this presentation allows me to juxtapose the cruelty of that kind of against the bleak absurdity of the situation she found herself in, where just one damn thing after another that just never seemed like it was going to stop. I got to scratch my itch of drawing superheroes, drawing my sisters and I as superheroes fighting a battle to the death. And this is, as I say here in the second panel, my wife said one of the wisest things I've ever heard. When people face an emergency, they just become more of what they already are, like they get superpowers. My wife truly, literally said that. And I think it's true. I think it's true. I think if you're a selfish jerk, when you're under stress, you become a more selfish jerk. And, you know, if you're basically a good person, then maybe you get better, but you also have your times of being a selfish jerk. My sisters and I are basically good people, but man, did we fight and snipe at each other. And a lot of it was kind of shifting roles, because I'm the oldest, and I was used to being in charge. Well, all of a sudden, I got a nurse. My younger sister is a nurse. She's in charge of stuff now. And so we used to just nip at each other about who knew best and who was doing what and who had done what last time. And again, this was part of my strong desire to be honest about the situation and even if it made me look bad from time to time. Comics transcend words plus drawing. I think this is an important strength of comics. And again, apologies to everybody who heard this earlier, but in my mind, comics are a lot like pop music. You know, if you write down the lyrics to a pop song, to a rock and roll song, they're usually bad poetry. They're not very good. And if you just listen to just the music of a pop song, it's not very interesting music. It's repetitive three chords over and over again. But you put the right words with the right music, and then all of a sudden you remember what it felt like to be 14 years old again, or you've got a piece of music that defines a generation. you've got yourself a Bob Dylan or a Bruce Springsteen or a Mozart. Well, Mozart, he had operas. They had words. You've got yourself a something that is better and bigger than words and music. Comics are the same thing. Comics can become more than words and pictures, I think. I think that's why they work. This is a sequence I drew in Mom's Cancer where my stepfather and I have having a conversation. And my dad is and was a physician and felt pretty strongly that Mom's case was medically hopeless, and she probably ought to just think about palliative care and think about making her life comfortable and not fighting quite as hard as she was. So we had this frequent conversation. So what I get to do here in comics is I get to recount the conversation we have on the phone and underneath it talk about the conversation we're really having subconsciously, subtextually. What we're really saying to each other is, Dad says, so you tell me what I'm missing. And I say, nope, not again. And Dad's saying through his words, choosing treatment was a selfish mistake. It's only prolonging her misery and delaying the inevitable. And I say, I think it beats being dead. This is the argument we're really having beneath the words that we're saying to each other. Get to play with time and space in comics. This is a conversation we often had with Mom about Mom taking full responsibility for her lung cancer at the same time she was doing all she could to evade responsibility for it. So I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but what I want to point out is comics let you play with time and space because as she's talking, she's losing her hair. Right? So this wasn't one conversation. This was a conversation that played out over weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks as she lost her hair. And it just tells you that we had the same damn talk over and over and over again. And you get that through the comic. You might pick that up. You might notice she's losing her hair. If you don't, that's fine. It's still, an interesting piece of conversation. But if you get that time is passing through this, it adds some depth to it. Okay, I don't need to talk about this. I'll move on. This is a page about going to the hospital. And this is a day at the hospital. And you go, and we saw at Stanford, she had a team of doctors. So you go see one doctor, then you go see another doctor, then you go see another doctor, and then you go back to see the first doctor, then you go see another doctor. And they all do the same tests. And it's push, and it's balance, and it's pull. Can you feel this? And as you start out the comic, there are recognizable things. You got hands and feet and elbows, and you got, hair and nose and fingers. And as you go through the day, as you go from place to place to place, as kind of hinted at by the different colored backgrounds, which also incidentally make a really nice, pleasing checkerboard pattern I was happy with, you get to the end of the day, and it's all abstraction. There's no recognizable body parts anymore. You aren't a collection of recognizable pieces. You're just a blur. You're a blob of protoplasm. And when they tell you to feel something at the end of the day, you can't feel a thing. It's just blackness. You got nothing left. Your day is done. Comics let you do that. I can't think of another medium you could tell a story that economically in. Mom's cancer led me into a field called graphic medicine, or occasionally called other things, comics and medicine, or illness narrative. And graphic medicine has been very important to me. Immodestly, Mom's cancer isn't the first work of graphic medicine. Certainly not the last, but it's something of a pioneer, having crossed over from web comics and that kind of thing. Graphic medicine is the idea that comics and healthcare can combine to enhance medical practice. You know, doctors can make comics about being doctors. Nurses make comics about being nurses. Caregivers like myself make comics about the people who are afflicted. Public health officials make comics to communicate with people who don't speak the same language they do. Comics are a very powerful medium. Comics are being taught in medical schools now. It's graphic medicine. Baby doctors take classes on making comics so that they can become more empathetic with their patients and then take these skills of making comics out to their patients and involve the patients kind of in their own care of saying, tell me what you're feeling, make a diary of this, tell me what's going on with you, draw some pictures, make a happy face or a sad face. You know, we're not asking you to write words, we're asking you to kind of tell the story through pictures and words in your own way. And we've actually had some international conferences on these events, on this topic. I helped organize a couple of these in Chicago and Toronto, and next one's in Scotland, and the one after that will be in Seattle, I hear. And these are just wonderful. It's a place where doctors, nurses, university professors, and cartoonists all get together. And I can't think of any other place where all those people would have anything to talk about. But we get together at these things, and we talk about the comics we've made and the things we've done with them and the research that's been done and how these comics have been applied to make people's lives better, to make better doctors, to help people through hard times, to teach people how to use their medications properly, or teach kids how to use inhalers, or get informed consent for children going through surgery. Comics have just a ton of uses. And this whole graphic medicine thing is just been a really, really nice outcome of having done Mom's Cancer. There's a lot of works of graphic medicine. These are some of the leading ones. And most of the authors of these have been guests at our various international conferences. Oh, I had these set up to go through automatically, but I'll go through. All of these are good books. They deal with Alzheimer's, with psychiatric problems. That's a pioneering work right there, Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin, or Holy Virgin Mary, by Justin Green. Special Exits about Alzheimer's. You'll Never Know is about PTSD, wartime PTSD. And if you want more information about any of that stuff, I'd really recommend you to go to graphicmedicine.org. And if you go to there, and let's see if I get back real quick. If you go to graphicmedicine.org, you'll talk to
her or him.
Those are the two people who run graphicmedicine.org. The woman is a nurse at Northwestern in Chicago, and the man in the top middle is a physician in the United Kingdom. And they're both terrific, and they'll tell you anything you want to know about graphic medicine. A lot of resources there, too, a lot of book reviews and links to other things and medical journal articles and all kinds of stuff. So let's back through it here. I'll catch up. Again, I recommend any of these books. So I want to talk about Whatever Happened to World Tomorrow, and kind of contrast that. It was such a joy after writing a graphic novel about cancer to write a graphic novel in which nobody had to get hurt to make it to complete the book. There was no suffering involved with this except perhaps my own. And I really enjoyed doing this. I kind of described what it was about before. I want to, again, try a reading of this. The first reading I thought went very well, by the way, so thank you for that. Appreciate that. I'm going to just read the first few pages of this book as well, and try to give you a feel for what it is and what it's about. It starts in May 1939, titled Pre-Flight, and you see the father and son walking along the street there. Pop and I wasted half the morning riding the train from Penn Station, then paying a dime to catch the subway to Queensboro Plaza for the free transfer to the World's Fair Flushing Line. Lowry Street, Bliss, Woodside, Fisk, all the way out to Willets Point, the last station on the line that was specially extended to carry us to the fair. A few years ago, this land was a dump, marshy mounds of coal ash from the city. Today it was the future, Pop's and mine. I smelled the fair's sweet, greasy steam before the train doors opened. Onshore breezes lofted the scents of tomorrow over hot, soft blacktop through our throng and toward the newly built spires of Manhattan in the distance. Flags and awnings snapped above the bridge that took us to the entrance. Pop, pop! We're almost there, I can see the gate. The day the New York World's Fair opened, 200,000 people walked through this gate and eight others, ringing 1,200 acres of national pavilions, industrial visions, scientific breakthroughs, exotic exhibitions, and thrilling rides. Before it closed on October 27, 1940, there'd be 45 million more. One adult, one child. 45 million people entered, imagining 45 million different tomorrows, and all left believing in the same one. One book, have a good time. Pop bought a map and a couple of guidebooks, plus a special World's Fair comic book for me. We were going to need the map. And Pop says, holy cow. The fair was laid out in areas dedicated to communication, transportation, production, and food. Different lands circling an imposing icon that tied them all together. The spire of the Trilon and the globe of the perisphere, which are the big spiky thing and the ball in the background there. Up a little more, hold it. Their contrasting forms carried a lot of symbolism. Triangle and circle, science and art, male and female, war and peace. Over the Bridge of Flags, around the Lagoon of Nations to the Court of Peace, more than 60 countries hosted pavilions large and small to show their best faces to the world. Not China. In mid-1939, it was too busy being invaded. Not Germany. It was too busy invading. By the time the fair closed, three pavilions became the poignant last outposts of nations that no longer existed: Lithuania, Poland, Czechoslovakia. An inscription on the wall of Czechoslovakia's pavilion read, "After the tempest of wrath has passed, the rule of thy country will return to thee, O Czech people." It was a lament too many would share in the years ahead. The world of tomorrow couldn't stanch the tempest of wrath already begun. And with that introduction, I want to talk a little bit about research here, because this was a very different project for me, process-wise. Mom's Cancer was a memoir, and I had to write down notes of what happened to us and do a little research on cancer, but the book is primarily about our family, so I had to be very, very alert to what was going on in the family, not a lot of external research. With What Are Up in the World Tomorrow, I really wanted to get this right. So, when you're writing a book, research is one thing. When you have to draw the things you're writing about, research takes on a whole nother dimension. It becomes a lot harder proposition. For example, I researched cars. I bought that. That's a model car at the top that I bought. It's about this big. It's a 1939 Ford, I think. I don't remember. But it's from the proper era. And so when I needed to, I'd take it out in the backyard and I'd shoot pictures of that model. Or I'd find pictures online. Tricky thing about pictures online is you don't know if the car's been renovated or not. So if you want a real 1939 car, you got to go find a 1939 car. So I did that. I tried to get the cars right. I tried to get the lampposts right. I found streetlights from 1939. If I was going to draw something, I wanted to make sure I had a reference for it, a citation for it. Subway cars. My God, did I research subway cars. I was so happy to find that car on top because you can see the rivet pattern. And so I copied the rivet pattern on the drawing. I got the rivets right. I was so thrilled to get the rivets right. I found the blueprints for that subway car. And I nailed that sucker. I was thrilled to find those. I can't even tell you. I don't know how people did things before the internet. I found the subway stop. I found the subway schedule, so I knew which stops and in which order they came, and I knew how much it cost to take a subway from downtown New York to the World's Fair. Oops, I don't know why I missed that. That's what the inside looked like, and that's how I drew it. And clothing and such, that goes without saying. By the way,
that's Clark Kent and Lois Lane.
Because there was a Superman comic book that came out in 1938. He went to the World's Fair in 1939. So Superman's going to the World's Fair at the same time my characters are. This is a picture of the people crowding to get into the World's Fair. And you can see some of the awning in the back that I drew and the flags snapping. And I got the patterns on the flags as right as I could. So this is the path you took to get from the subway to the gate of the fair. And this is what the gate of the fair looked like. These ticket booths were made out of wood slats with kind of a chrome trim around them. And so I tried to get that as right as I could. Even though it's just like a little sliver on the side of the page, I really wanted that to be right. I found lots of maps of the World's Fair. I bought this one on eBay, and I actually included it in the book later. That's a whole other digression. This map was published by General Motors because they had one of the exhibits at the fair, and I, of course, had to get General Motors' permission to use it because they copyrighted it. So I went to General Motors, and I said, what would it take for me to put this in my book? And they said, that's not ours. And I said, yes, it is. I said, no, we didn't do that. I said, yes, you did. And I had convinced General Motors that they published this map before they let me use it. And I think I paid them $300 or something for it. But the big argument, I didn't have any trouble getting permission. My argument was I had to convince them it was theirs. So I had this map, and I plotted out the path that my characters took through the whole World's Fair during the course of their day. And I drew the buildings along the side of the World's Fair to match the actual buildings that were there. This building on the bottom is not reversed. That's just the opposite side of it. If you were standing on the far side of the building, it's on the right side of the picture I drew with the radio antenna and so forth. I did move the radio antenna a little bit. I feel kind of guilty about that. But I did my best. Another shot looking down the same street and a postcard. So that's just like the first five pages. I was telling some folks earlier, to try to get this right, and maybe this is just my OCD or whatever, for World of Tomorrow, I collected 4,000 pages of reference. And so if I was going to draw a Coke bottle in 1945, or I was going to draw If I was going to draw something in 1965 or 1975, I had a model for it. I had a source. I had a reference. And nobody has called me out on any of that yet. Because I just know somewhere out there, there's some guy who really loves 1939 subway cars. I know there is. And as far as I know, none of them have caught me. I made one error that has been caught and unfortunately not been able to correct. And then I did one thing wrong on purpose just for creative license because I needed to. Anyway, only one guy caught that. I hate him. And the last mechanical monster, as I say, this was just for fun. After doing a comic about cancer and then doing this heavily researched thing, it was just fun for me to draw a comic about an old man and his giant robot. And I called it an experiment in progress because by this time, several years had passed since Mom's cancer, and web comics had gotten pretty sophisticated. They'd gotten pretty high-powered. There are web portals now that host web comics. It's not just Jim or Judy in the back room, typing things out and putting them on AOL anymore. It's a big business. People make actual money at it. And I just wanted to see if it was possible to draw pictures and put them online and not tell anybody about it and have people come and read it. It was an experiment. I just wanted to see if you could do that anymore because that's kind of how Mom's cancer worked. And I didn't have another Mom's cancer in me. There's no sequel to it. I just wanted to see if that would work. And it kind of did. So I'm not going to bother reading this to you, but here's the first several pages of Last Mechanical Monster. And it's about a mad scientist who's been in prison. In 1941, he built an army of 30 giant robots to rob banks and cause general mayhem. And he's been in jail for 65 years, and he gets out of jail, and he puts on the tuxedo he had on back in 1941 when he was caught, and he cranks up the watch he had. The warden's trying to be nice to him and give him a business card of a buddy, and you know, the old man's not having any of it. At the end, he says he shall be the first to die. The question is, this story is about how we want to be remembered. You know, what we do, how we want to be remembered. If you're an old man and you find out you've got one giant robot left, what do you do with it? Do you try to redeem your reputation? Do you try to be good? Do you try to do right? Or do you try to get back at all those people who, you know, messed you up 60 years ago? And so it's kind of a story about that. It's a story about legacy. And maybe it's because I'm getting just a little older, but it's kind of like, well, what do you want to leave behind on Earth? You know, it has a point. It's not just all fun and games. I try to make sure everything I do has some kind of point or subtext or, you know, overarching idea to it. But mostly this was just fun to draw, and I just had such a hoot doing this. I did it for about a year and a half. This is another panel from it. This is the old man realizing he's misprogrammed his robot. And then this is just a panel I particularly liked where the old man's got the crap beat out of him. He's all bandaged up, and he's sitting there in his underwear and socks, and he's wondering if maybe he's just done everything all wrong in his life. This comic went on to be nominated for a couple Eisner Awards last two years in a row for Best Webcomic. Didn't win, but I thought the nomination was pretty much proof that the experiment succeeded. It got some readers and has... I don't tell everybody this because contracts haven't been signed, but it's got a pretty good chance of showing up in print in 2017. So if I can get somebody to sign a contract, it'll be in print in 2017 or maybe 18. So, success. I'll take that. I want to talk about general terms, why comics work, why I think comics work. Comics work, I think, because they distill reality and stories to their essence. A comic is kind of the worn down, polished rock of experience. You know, it's not a photograph. If you want to remember something precisely, you take a picture of it. But a comic is the essence of a thing with everything extraneous removed. It's taking away everything that's unnecessary and just leaving you with that one little gem of an idea or an experience, or you know, something that's true, if it's done right. If it's done wrong, it's just confusing and useless. But I think that's true. Comics theorist Scott McCloud, whom some of you may be familiar with, talks about comics working specifically because of this lack of detail. Because comics are so abstract, they're so simplified, that there's so little detail to hold on to. A black and white comic is lines on a piece of paper that the there it is. Hold that up. So Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. Thank you. It's all in here. That the reader has to fill in details with information from their own lives. There's so much missing in the drawing, in the story, in the narrative, that the reader fills in the missing information with details from themselves. And when that's really working, when that's really firing all cylinders, sometimes it feels like you just tapped right into the reader's brain. It's like a direct transfer. It's like a mental transfer. I've had people come up to me at talks and say, especially after mom's cancer, you know, we had illness in my family. It wasn't cancer. It was something else. And it wasn't my mom. It was my dad. And I don't have two sisters. I have five brothers. But it was like you were in our living room watching us. You know, nothing was the same. Nothing, none of the specifics were the same. But the generality, the experience was universal. And it seems like, and this is a paradox I don't quite understand. I haven't learned how to use yet. The more specific you get, the more general the experience is to the reader. It's a marvelous thing. It's really powerful when you see it work. The best example I know of that sort of captures this idea of minimalism in comics is Charlie Brown. This is the face of Charlie Brown, and it's two dots and a curve and a squiggly line. It's four marks on a piece of paper, four black marks on a piece of paper. And you look at that, and it'll break your heart. Or make you overjoyed, you know. I was talking at dinner about, you know, people whose work is seems simple but it's hard to copy. At top of the list for me is Charles Schulz, because Charles Schulz drew this, four lines. I can't draw. I don't know how to do that. That's amazing what that is. What that represents right there. It's just that's the power of comics. That right there. That's all you need to know about the power of comics. You know, when Charlie Brown gets a rock in his trick or treat bag, or when Charlie Brown doesn't get Valentine's at the mailbox. That's universal, man. That's all of us, you know, being losers. And it's that direct tap from the creator to the reader. So I have a few quotes that I like to end talks with that to me sort of encapsulate what comics and making comics is all about. And the first one is by a philosopher and mathematician named Blaise Pascal, who is not a cartoonist at all. But he said, "I apologize that I made this letter so short, or so long. I did not have time to make it short." There's a lot of truth to that, because it takes time to simplify. It's hard. The hardest thing to do in comics is make it look easy. And I think that's true for comedy. It's true for a lot of things. It's easy to write a long letter. It's hard to write a good short letter. I think that's true. Another quote I like is by a Victorian cartoonist named Phil May. And Phil May was working in this period when art was very detailed, very hyper-detailed, very screechy-scratchy, lots of detail, lots of cross-hatching, lots of black and, you know, filigree and doodads around the outside. And you can just picture these amazing Victorian drawings that just kind of go on forever. And Phil had slacked off a little bit. And his editor thought he wasn't getting his money's worth out of Phil May. And so the editor says, "Phil, how about putting some more lines in your drawing?" And Phil said, "When I can leave out half the lines I now use, I shall want six times the money." Phil May is a cartoonist after my own heart. Whenever I change something, I redraw often. When I make a mistake, when I redraw something, I always make it simpler. I never make it more complicated. Whenever I redraw something, it's always to simplify it, never to make it complex. Another quote I like is by a cartoonist named Alex Toth, who was very active in the, I guess, maybe starting 50s, but certainly the 60s and 70s. He did a lot of designs for characters like a lot of comic books, a lot of character design for Space Ghost and Johnny Quest and things like that. A real master of the medium. And he said, "I spent the first half of my career learning what to put into my art and the second half learning what to leave out." And I think I'm kind of, I like to think I'm there too. I like to think that's the hump I'm coming over and working. I think you spend another 20, 30 years just trying to figure out what to leave out of your art, because I think that's the essence of it. But my very favorite quote about comics is by a cartoonist named Larry Gonick, who did a series about the history of the universe and the history of the world. They're basically nonfiction comics, but very entertaining. You or your kids might have come across them in school at one point. And Larry Gonick said, "Our brains represent things in some stripped-down, abstracted way. We don't remember things as photographs or movies. We remember them as cartoons." I think that's absolutely right. You know, when you when you have a memory, you don't remember the details of it. You don't remember what color the carpet and the drapes were. You don't remember if the sky was cloudy or blue that day. You remember the essence of the situation. You remember the people. You remember the feeling you had when you were there with them. That's a cartoon. That's reality stripped to its essence. And I think that's part of why comics work and why sometimes you get this magic of the direct connection between the creator and the reader. That, as I say, it's just kind of a delight when that magic happens. And with that, I'm done. So I'd be happy to answer any questions or anything you don't have about anything. They're going to bring a mic around, so
just want to remind you that I'm bringing a microphone around. And two things I forgot to mention at the beginning, and I don't want to forget, is number one, there is a bookseller out in the lobby, so if you want to buy a copy of Mom's Cancer while Brian is here, and I'm sure he would be happy to sign it.
I would.
So those are out in the lobby. And then we also have evaluations over in the corner of the room, so if you have the time to fill out an evaluation, we really appreciate it. So now, any questions? Those people who had their hands up with questions.
I'd like to ask a bit about your background, because you majored in physics, right?
Yeah.
And you were a science writer, and so I was wondering if Mom's Cancer took you, or the success of Mom's Cancer took you off guard at all, or if you were already en route to that sort of career and you decided to go with it. I'm
trying to decide how honest I want to be.
Very. Always.
I've always wanted to be a cartoonist. And when I was, 16, 17, 18, 19, I tried very hard to be a professional one. And at the time, if you didn't draw for Marvel or DC or do a comic strip, there weren't a lot of options. And I tried hard at those things. And I actually had to try out with DC to draw, The Flash or something. And failed. Like a lot of people in a lot of creative fields, I failed. So I did other things. I became a newspaper reporter for a while, and I was a chemist for a while, and I did other things, but I kept drawing. I kind of tried to improve my skills, and I did freelance things from time to time. I illustrated a light bulb catalog once. You'd be amazed how many different sizes and shapes of light bulbs there are, and I drew them all. So I tried to keep my hand in, and I tried to get better, and I'd submit a comic strip to the syndicates once in a while because I really thought I wanted to be a syndicated cartoonist back when that meant something. And got enough encouragement to keep trying. Never had a breakthrough, but got enough encouragement to keep trying. So when Mom's Cancer came along, I felt like I had the skills. I thought I could do it. I thought I could pull it off. I think I was ready. So was I surprised? I was gratified. But everything I do, everything I write, I'm already imagining the Pulitzer Prize acceptance speech. so I'm always, most of my career is infused with a sense of vague disappointment, I think. But no, I'm very gratified. I mean, Mom's Cancer has just been huge. It's still in print. It was published in 2006. It's still in print. If you know anything about publishing, you know how remarkable it is for a book to stay in print for 10 years. That's great. And one reason it stays in print is because people like my host use it in classrooms and stuff like that. The idea that this thing I did is still being read and used around the world in three different languages. I took a slide out right before we started, but one of the very first and most gratifying emails I got was while Mom's Cancer was still a webcomic, was from a nursing teacher in Australia. And what she was asking, she asked permission to copy pages of Mom's Cancer off the internet and give them to her nursing students so that they'd be prepared to face the situations they'd find taking care of their patients out in the outback. And she, That was the first time I really understood the instantaneous worldwide reach of the web. I didn't get it until then. But the idea that somebody who teaches nursing in Australia thought my little family's little story, set in literally half a world away, would have some meaning to their patients out in the outback, just blew me away. It still blows me away. And I hear enough stories like that from time to time that if I never do anything else, if Mom's Cancer is on my tombstone, I'm fine with that. I think that's wonderful. That's a tremendous legacy I'm very happy with. So I was ready. Somebody else had a question.
So when you're working on a book, do you finish a page and then move on, or are you working on multiple pages, and do you ever have to go back and revise it completely because it didn't fit the later development of the story?
Yes, especially with Mom's Cancer, because Mom's Cancer was done about in real time. The story, it's only 128 pages, but it covers about a year and a half or 2 years of time. And so, as often happens to cartoonists in these things, by the time I got to the end of the book, the way I was drawing the characters and such looked completely different from the way they were at the start of the book. They drifted. And so when it came time to go from online to putting them in print, I had to redraw about half the thing. Did a lot of editing in the process. I was a ruthless editor. Mom's Cancer was all about editing, and anything that didn't advance Mom's story got cut out. There were a lot of parts of Mom's Cancer of me whining about how horrible this was for me, and I realized I'm not the story. I'm the one telling the story, but it's my mom's story. I just kept a laser-like focus on that. Does it advance Mom's story? And if it did, it was in, and if it didn't, it was out. In general, I work sequentially, and I like to work in order of the story because you don't want to add something here and then have to go back and fix up stuff that came before. You know, I want to be able to add something on page 55 and then have it pay off on page 122, not draw something on page 22 and say, oh, crap, now I got to go change the last 90 pages to make that work out. So I like to generally do things in order. It's interesting because the work process I have found really depends on the nature of the story. Like for Last Mechanical Monster, let me back up. The way cartooning generally works is, at least old school cartooning, is you write it, you pencil it, which is just literally penciling, using pencil lines on the paper, and then you ink it. That's old school cartooning, but that's kind of the nuts and bolts. I do have friends, by the way, who are more visual cartoonists, and they just start drawing stuff. That's how they don't write first, they just start drawing, and the story comes out of their drawings, and that's voodoo, man. I don't know how they do that. I really admire that. I script it. It kind of comes out like a stage play or a radio play with little doodles in the side. And then I pencil it, and then I ink it. With The Last Mechanical Monster, I really thought I was clever. I was going to write the whole thing, pencil the whole thing, and ink the whole thing because I wanted to avoid that problem of drift. I wanted to avoid the problem of getting the end and having to redraw something because I was drawing it differently. And I thought that would solve the problem. And I penciled 110 pages. Had 110 pages. They're this big, 110 of them. And I got that done, and I said, man, this is a slog. This really sucks. I realized it was bad. After 110 pages that took months and months and months of work, I realized it was bad, and I wasn't having any fun. If I wasn't having any fun drawing it, nobody was going to have any fun reading it. And so I rewrote the story, and I turned those 110 pages over, and I started penciling again. But this time I penciled and inked in batches of like 3 or 4 pages. I'd pencil and ink and get a chunk done because it meant a lot to me to get a chunk done. Instead of, when I would pencil 110 pages, it felt like I wasn't getting anything done because it was going to be months before I got around to inking those things. So for me, I really like working in discrete units. Pencil and ink a few at a time. Hooray! I got 5 pages done this week or whatever it was. And then do the next batch later. That works for me, but other people have different methods. So whatever works. Each project, I think, needs its own thing, too.
I really loved listening to you read out loud from all of your comics. And I was wondering if you had thought about accessibility at all, especially in terms of how people who use screen readers might access web comics, and whether just having a JPEG image, you know, that's not something they can get to. So if you'd thought about implementing that kind of description in your webcomic work so that you could make that story more accessible, or if there are communities of artists maybe in the medical graphic community or elsewhere who are already trying to think about that?
That's a terrific question. I know some people are trying to think about it, and I think there's some... people are having trouble with like standardization of formats and things like that. Some people are thinking about it. I personally had no such technical skills when I was doing my webcomics, and that was I wouldn't have been able to tackle that. But it's a conversation I've had with my publisher, particularly when it comes to ebooks, because both of my books are available as in electronic format. And then the question arises, well, why don't we do things like that? And the answer I get is, well, it would cost money. And the other answer is there's not really a standardized format for that kind of thing as far as I know. There are other professional cartoonists here who might know better than me, but it's a conversation we've had many times, and it's a great frustration to me that nothing has really come of it. There's only so much I can do when I'm dealing with a publisher. You know, I'd like a lot of things to happen. But I think it's a great question. I think it's going to happen. I don't know how, and I don't know who's going to do it. But from these graphic medicine conferences I've been to, I know it's a question that's arisen in many different works in many different countries, and it's going to crack soon. Somebody's going to figure out a way to get it done and do it right. I don't know if it'll be me. Hi, Sophia.
Hi. When you were drawing the scene, when you were just sitting there and watching TV, when you got the phone call, was the Powerpuff Girls the first like cartoon that came to your mind?
Do you know why I did that? Is because I really like the Powerpuff Girls, and I collect original artwork. I collect artwork from friends of mine, like Raina Telgemeier. We had a conversation earlier about Raina Telgemeier. It's a friend of mine. I collect original art, and I have a cell. You know, when they make animation, they draw it on transparencies. I have that cell from the Powerpuff Girls cartoon. So I took the cell off the wall, and I put it in my scanner, and I scanned it. So that's my little tribute to the Powerpuff Girls, is I actually own the cell that's in that page. So I love the Powerpuff Girls. I thought they were terrific.
Yeah.
But I was not literally watching the Powerpuff Girls. I have no idea what I was really watching, but I needed to put something on the screen, so I said, I'll use that.
Yeah. Cool.
It's probably a copyright violation, too, by the way, so don't tell anybody.
Curious to know if your mom's still alive and what she thought of your book.
I'll start with the last part first. I said when I introduced Mom's Cancer that I put it online anonymously, and part of the anonymity was I didn't even tell my family I was doing it, and part of the reason for that was I was a coward, and another part of the reason was sort of I didn't want to do anything to add any stress to what was already going on. Everybody was having a hard enough time already without wondering about what Brian was doing over in the corner. And then there was sort of the anthropologist's approach of not letting the observed know they're being observed. So I kind of just kept to myself and didn't tell anybody about it for a long time until it went viral. And all of a sudden, not 20 people a day were reading it, but 10,000 people a day were reading it. And I got an email from a guy who said, hey, I think I know your sister. And I said, oh, shit. Sorry, Sophia.
I said, oh, shit.
And so I called my family that night, or that day. I called my mom and I called my sisters and I said, go take a look at this. Tell me what you think. Just cringing. It just killed me. And Mom called back right away, and fortunately, Mom loved it. She thought it was terrific. If Mom hadn't been at all unhappy, I would have just killed the whole thing, taken it off, and it'd be gone. Never would have happened. Mom loved it. She always had a kind of very dramatic flair. When she moved, she lived in Hollywood briefly, and she worked as an extra in movies. So there's a couple of movies where I can still watch the movie and see her in the background, you know. And so she always had this kind of hidden flamboyance to her. And I think she really enjoyed this new public face I was giving her. She got fan mail. She got letters from people who said they'd quit smoking because of her example, and that meant a lot to her. She was always a woman who sought purpose in life, and I think she saw that this was a way to turn this horrible, horrible thing happening to her into something good, get something good out of it, was letting me tell her story. So Mom was alive, and spoiler alert, the book Mom's Cancer ends with Mom going into remission, and she and my sisters moving together to Southern California. Between the time the webcomic ended and the book went into print, she relapsed. And she passed away just before, actually, she passed away the day before the final files were due to the printer. So she had a chance to review things, early proofs and things like that. But we just had time, literally my editor and I on the phone, me dictating something to her. The very, very last page of Mom's Cancer is a little update on what had happened to her. She passed away just before publication. The best part of Mom's Cancer, however, if you get the book, is Mom wrote an afterword for it. And I just love what she wrote. And I did almost no editing to it. I mean, it's her voice. And it's her talking about her experience and what she learned and what advice she would have for somebody in that situation about, you know, getting the most out of life. And it's just, if the book were nothing but my mom's afterword, I think it'd still be worth, you know, $14, $15. I just think it's great. Anything else?
You talked a lot about the amount of research you did. I'm going to ask about whatever happened to the world of tomorrow, the vast amount of research you did. Oftentimes when that happens, you have to leave something out that you really, really loved but just didn't fit.
Yes, a ton.
Got an example of it?
Oh, gosh. I have to think about that. Well, I left out the Vietnam War. No, but I did a lot of research on it. I did because there's a chapter in the book that's set in 1965, and I did a lot of research on it. And then I decided the Vietnam War is something you kind of either go all in on or you don't go anywhere near at all. I couldn't do 4 pages on the Vietnam War. You know, I didn't know how to do that. So I left it out of the story. It's mentioned, but it's not an important part of what happens to those characters on that day. It's you know, they're watching spaceships lift off from Cape Canaveral. That's what they're doing in 1965. They're not slogging through Laos or whatever. So that's one. That was a big one. Well, like I said, I collected 3,000 or 4,000 pages of stuff, and the book is only, you know, the book is 208 pages long, so that's a pretty big ratio. But you know that. He writes all kinds of books. Anything else, please?
How would you suggest somebody reads a graphic novel? Do you look at the pictures first, look at the words, and read the whole thing over again?
What a fantastic question. What a fantastic question. That's a hard question for people like me who kind of grew up reading and drawing and making comics. We don't always understand why someone asked that question. And I didn't get that question either, and I didn't understand it either until I tried to read an X-Men comic in the 90s. And I opened this thing up, and I had no freaking idea what was going on in this comic. Because it was just poorly composed, and there was stuff going on all over the page, and the words didn't have any relation. And then I got it, and I said, oh, this is what it feels like to open up a comic and not know how to read it. And I get that. The words draw the eye through the page. The words, when you're making a comic, the words come first. Because the word, and people don't know this. I mean, people starting to make comics, like my friend Sophia here, they'll draw the picture and then they'll put the words around it. That's backwards. You always put the words first and you compose the page so that the eye follows the words through the page. Boom, 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 left to right, top to bottom, through the page, and it just pulls you on through, and then you make your art fit. And then then the composition and some deeper thoughts about how to tell the story visually of where your motion lines are going and how the whole page is composed and how this page is composed compared to the one right next to it. There's a lot that goes into the art of a page, but the words always come first. So I wouldn't read all the words. The panel is the essentially unit of comic making, I think, the square box. I would say, for me, it happens instantaneously, so it's hard for me to say, but word, picture, word, picture, word, picture. And I think that's right. That's probably the way the brain works. Do you guys, there's a couple of comic making people back here. Do you guys have anything theoretical or practical to say about that?
So I teach comics classes in Ann Arbor. And so I guess, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about this with my adult students and my kids' students is when you're watching a movie and you're confused, you have to hit rewind. The interface becomes apparent and you're removed from the experience of the story. In a comic, you can zigzag back and forth between word and picture, and even if you don't immediately understand the connection between what's said in the balloon and what's the expression on the face, because I guess some of your examples, there was sort of an intentional dissonance.
Yes.
In terms of like the words are saying one thing, but the tightrope walking is saying another thing, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't make that immediate connection, you can zigzag back and forth until that connection is made in your mind, and you're not hitting rewind. the interface vanishes because it's all happening on the page, right?
It's one of my favorite things to do when I'm making comics is have the words and pictures do entirely different things and make the reader, without an abundance of effort, make the connection themselves. And filmmakers do the similar thing. There was a famous experiment. I don't remember the details of it, but I think a Russian filmmaker, very early in the days of filmmaking, spliced together a movie, and it was a series of images, and one image was just a male face just looking very neutrally. And then the next image was, you know, a bloody slaughter, very neutral, a romantic scene, very neutral, you know, an exciting road race. And the male face was the same, but how it was juxtaposed with the images around it led the viewer to interpret that expression differently. Oh, he's angry. Oh, he's sad. Oh, he's excited. Oh, he's in love. The face didn't change. What was around the face changed. And comics work the same. Comics, words, and images can work the same way, where if the words are doing one thing, the picture's doing another. I like to exercise the reader's mind. I think readers like to have their minds exercised. I like to leave little puzzles or have them figure things out without, you know, just making it a difficult slog. I don't want to make it hard on anybody. One of my fundamental tenets of making comics is if the reader has to stop and figure out what's going on or what they're supposed to read next, you failed. It's got to be painless and easy. You've got to just go through the page, and if the reader has to stop and rewind, that's bad comic making as far as I'm concerned. Not everybody feels the same way. There's some comic artists, cartoonists who've had very good careers making very confusing comics, but it's not my philosophy. Then that's why I'm not Chris Ware. Anything else? Well, I have had such a nice time. I guess I'll be here a while, and please feel free to, you know, talk or ask or anything. I'm at your disposal, and thank you. It's been great.